today on Against the Grain. What does fossil fuel extraction and the environmental damage it causes have to do with the exploitation of women? Can harm to the environment be linked to harm done to women's bodies and women's labor? I'm CS. Sean Parson and Emily Ray examine the oil industry and natural resource extraction in light of patriarchal ideas and practices coming right up. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. The extraction of oil involves doing violence to the earth. Gigantic and powerful machines penetrate the terrain, and irreplaceable natural resources are permanently removed. Fossil fuel extraction is also, writes Sean Parson and Emily Ray, is also a masculinized activity, an activity associated with men and male labor, and the kind of entitlement that men have come to feel in relation to the environment. What does that mean then for women, for how women are treated and how they are portrayed by the energy industry? Can violence done to the terrain be linked to the exploitation of women's bodies and women's labor? Sean Parson and Emily Ray certainly think so. They co-wrote a paper called Drill Baby Drill, Labor, Accumulation, and the Sexualization of Resource Extraction. In it, the two scholars apply insights from ecofeminism, Marxism, and Freudianism to the situation of women in and around the oil fields. They also highlight how women's bodies are sexualized in oil industry-related advertisements. Sean Parson is Assistant Professor of Politics and International Affairs at Northern Arizona University. Emily Ray is Assistant Professor of Political Science at Sonoma State University. When I spoke with them recently, I began by asking Emily what she and Sean were hoping or trying to do with their paper.
What we were trying to do is talk about the different ways that gender plays a role in the way that labor is produced and the way resources are extracted. So we typically think about land, labor, and capital as the inputs for the economy, but there's always gendered and racial dimensions to the way those inputs are created and how they get used in the economy. So we were trying to draw attention to the gendered aspect in particular of the way that labor is produced in the oil sands and the Bakken in particular. And in doing that, we realized that there were a couple different ways to talk about that. There's the way that women's labor is brought into the oil sands, and there's also the way that women are sexualized in advertising the oil sands. And what's especially, I guess, poignant about this is that this is often called ethical oil as a good alternative to fossil fuels that we normally think about. So in the process of labeling this an ethical way to extract resources, there are these deeply unethical and troubling practices around gender.
Tell us about the Bakken Shale Formation and where it's found.
The Bakken is found in parts of North Dakota, Manitoba, Montana, and Saskatchewan. And the U.S. Geologic Survey estimates there's about 7.4 billion barrels of recoverable oil that's beneath the surface. And so this is part of what contributes to the boomtown phenomenon. So companies go in and they lease the land, and then they use these really destructive extractive practices. Typically, oil sand is harder to extract than conventional oil, so it takes a lot more energy, and it's usually a lot more destructive to the environment in the process. And so this is taking place in boomtown, so places like North Dakota that have been subject to the ups and downs of the oil economy for some time.
So the boomtowns that you mentioned, are we talking about temporary camps? Are we talking about municipalities that have sprung up and then maybe at a certain point wither a bit because of the ups and downs of the oil market? Tell us about the boom towns and the boom town phenomenon.
The boom towns refer to both the municipalities, the local towns like Williston, North Dakota, is fairly well known as a boom town. And so those towns have been experiencing really rapid growth. The other piece of this is that there are temporary labor camps that are colloquially called man camps. And those are camps that are primarily inhabited by men who are coming in temporarily just to do the labor, the short-term labor of extraction. And those camps are what's causing a lot of the social and cultural pressures in and around these towns that have some stable residential population. And then there'll be this influx of mostly men coming from all over the country to drive trucks, to work on the rigs. And this is really problematic, especially from a gender aspect, because there's this tremendous uptick in domestic and sexual violence that accompanies the man camps popping in around these towns. And a lot of these towns are already in close proximity to indigenous reservations. And so this is also providing an uptick in sexual assault and kidnapping of Native women who live near and around the boom towns.
What proportion of workers in the energy industry are men?
Well, the vast majority of them are men. The American Petroleum Institute says that women account for 17% of the total employment in the combined oil and natural gas and petrochemical industries.
17%.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So it really is majority men, and they don't plan usually on staying and settling. And so there's some tension between these small man camps that have really low quality places to live and poor infrastructure. And then people thinking about maybe bringing partners, spouses, wives, children to stay there a little bit longer to maybe make a permanent residence. And then that's putting a lot of pressure on creating these really big subdivisions very quickly and cheaply. But since the labor changes, the labor needs change, there's all of these neighborhoods, if you will, that are essentially unpopulated because there haven't been enough men who are employed to stick around. So it's creating these really precarious conditions for the stability of these towns.
And you write that the sex industry has been part of the oil labor economy.
Yes. So the sex industry includes a lot of strip clubs popping up in these towns, and prostitution often found on, you know, the normal internet searches or clubs or bars. And part of the pressure of the sex industry is that not only is that contributing to sexual violence and sometimes domestic violence, but it's also not counted when we're talking about the kinds of economic changes that take place to these towns. It's considered part of a fringe or black market economy. So it's often not much in discussion about the way that women's work is impacted in the creation of these boom towns.
To what extent are women now being recruited to fill white collar and blue collar positions in that industry?
So that's a goal of some of these petrochemical industries, to start bringing more women into the white collar end of the labor force. However, a lot of the women that are talked about in the industry come from the blue collar end of the labor force. So there's this interesting trade magazine, the Bakken Oil Report, and they did some interviews with women who are working in the industry, but it was exclusively women who are in the blue collar sector. And it's called The Bold, the Brave, the Beautiful Women in the Bakken. So, of course, we can start to think of some of the sexist dimensions of this, that these women are identified by how they look, the quality of their hair, if they look younger than their age, and what makes them bold and brave. So the assumption here, of course, is that it would take a certain kind of woman to have the courage to go to work in this male-dominated environment and also to do the kind of work that's typically coded as masculine and male. And so describing these women, each of them have discussed or mentioned something of the threat of sexual violence or discrimination in the workplace, but this is an oil trade magazine, and so they move past that very quickly in the interview, and they mostly talk about ways that they have had to survive and using the jobs that are available to them to do so. So women have described hunger, being able to pay for their children, as the driving motivation to go to work in some of these places. And one of the aspects of this is that the oil companies are making this available labor for women as if this is a really great opportunity and that this is what equal opportunity looks like. But it's really equal opportunity to participate in an exploitative labor environment that's exploitative to men as well. It's not exclusive exploitation. And so this is not a very good way to think about how to integrate women into a workforce by giving them a chance to do this kind of precarious and dangerous labor at a very low wage.
And can we expect that there might be at least some gender-based hiring discrimination?
I think that goes without saying, especially in the way that the women describe how they got these jobs. They had to have some kind of trade that, again, is typically coded as masculine or male. And so they've had to fight very hard to prove that they can drive a truck or that they can do the jobs that men probably are assumed to already be in possession of those skills. And the women have additional burdens outside the workplace. In this piece, the women describe that they know better than to go to the bars late at night. They know better than to go to the grocery store at 2 a.m. because they're trying to minimize their risk of assault and violence, sexual violence.
That's the voice of Emily Ray. She's assistant professor of political science at Sonoma State University. And we're talking about a paper that she co-authored with Sean Parson about labor accumulation and the sexualization of resource extraction, looking at the extraction of oil and the way that is gendered and sexualized. And Sean Parson joins us also on Against the Grain. He's assistant professor of politics and international affairs at Northern Arizona University. And Sean, one of these women profiled in this oil and gas industry magazine, she is discussed in relation to a rather famous ancestor, right?
Yeah, she is. This woman, Chauvin, is referred to multiple times through her great-grandfather. Her great-grandfather is Daniel Boone. And in the piece, they actually quote and say, five great-grandfathers back in Chauvin's family tree sits Daniel Boone, an American icon, a pioneer, frontiersman, and explorer. Chauvin's got a little of his blood and a whole lot of his spirit. And I think it's really important that even when describing these women, they always have to describe them in this exceptional way. And in this case, they have to go back to a male ancestor, kind of a founder of the American frontier narrative, to kind of provide her uniqueness. She's an exceptional woman. This is something that goes beyond the traditional gender norm, and this is why she's transgressing these boundaries.
Do we have any information about the extent to which female workers in the oil industry experience harassment on the job?
Yeah, we have not actually found any data on sexual assault or harassment rates amongst female workers in the oil field, but we have found some data on general increases in sexual assault in areas surrounding boom towns. So according to the North Dakota Council on Abused Women, they found that there was 4,807 new victims in 2013, a huge boost from previous years. And with that, we also found that there was increased, about a tripling of crime and violent crime, including sexual assault and human trafficking in Williston, Watford City, and Fort Buford, all around the oil fields as well.
And we can attribute these kind of figures to the fact that there are so many males opposed to females, and possibly, you tell me, the masculinist context and maybe a framework within which these men work?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to make an essentialist statement that men always commit violent crimes and women are always victims of them. But I think the cultural context of extraction is absolutely characterized as masculine. And as we get into in our research, there is some anxiety around men being perceived in a certain way with the kind of work that they're doing, and that this work is something that only men can do. And this is certainly not exclusive to North Dakota, but we see a real concentration of these attitudes with economic pressure in this place. And so you can see a real uptick in violence towards women and domestic violence especially.
So in this paper, the two of you write that in the oil industry, women are considered part of nature. And as a way of getting into what that means and what you mean by that, I'd like to ask you about Val Plumwood. She was an Australian philosopher. And what did she say about how rationality on the one hand and the emotional and the natural on the other have been prioritized?
Yeah, so Val Plumwood in Feminism and the Mastery of Nature highlights the kind of long history in Western philosophy of separating the material and the immaterial, the mind, the body. And then from the Greeks on in the Western canon, genderizing those so that the body becomes associated with the feminine and the mind associated with the man, with the masculine. Same with things like civilization, nature, society and nature. And in her work, she argues that this kind of dualism is hierarchical, and we value that which we define as masculine in a way and denigrate that which is defined as feminine. And then so in this work, she kind of argues that by constructing women as closer to nature, we exclude them from political realm, we exclude their arguments by defining it inherently as being more emotional, and we therefore also justify the exploitation of women under the same rubric that we justify the exploitation of nature. Both these are devalued subjects that are hostile or even in opposition to civilizational masculine progress. That's pretty much the main point she works on. And other ecofeminists have kind of expanded on that, kind of highlighting the multiple ways in which this closer to nature relationship gets used in order to link women to the natural world and then link the exploitation of women to being justified under the same kind of logic. Logic of accessibility, logic of entitlement, logic of having lesser value. You know, even people like Vandana Shiva in her work Staying Alive argues that women, because of their closeness to nature in the social reproductive realm, become acceptable to be mistreated as industrial society tries to conquer nature and progress technologically and economically. Women become a hidden victim of that kind of industrial logic.
What does social reproduction mean in the context in which you're using it?
I'm borrowing it from Silvia Federici, who uses kind of through Marx this idea that domestic labor, which is primarily the function of women in kind of historical and contemporary capitalist society, is foundational to the development of capitalism. So for the worker to go to work, they need to have their basic social reproduction met. They need to have food, clothing, housing. They need to have sexual enjoyment. They need to have all those aspects that are required. And this becomes exploited labor that capitalist system uses from primarily women to subsidize kind of the wages that go to male workers. And that's in addition to the actual reproductive labor that women provide in creating the next generation of workers to be exploited.
Yeah, I'd like to tag on to that as well, that we can see this in the way that Earth is also considered a feminine body. We call it Mother Earth or a goddess. And so there's this expectation of reproduction from Mother Earth to produce the conditions of life and to produce life itself. And likewise, when women are considered of the earth or closer to the earth, there's an expectation that women are also producing new life and that that is their primary role, and that God has given man both earth and women to produce the means for life and to ensure their prosperity. And so when both women and earth are viewed in the same way, then the justification for extraction and for use without compensation or consideration makes sense to take the two of those together when we're looking at extractive industry and the way women are treated both inside and outside of that labor force.
Speaking of what you were saying, Sean, about a sense of entitlement, what did the English philosopher Francis Bacon write about man and specifically man's understanding of and control over nature?
Francis Bacon has been famously deconstructed and highlighted by ecofeminist writers as one of the main founders of the scientific method and one of the most important thinkers in the Enlightenment. He often is shown as kind of highlighting the sexual component of this process. So he famously said in discussing scientific method, "The secret workings of nature do not reveal themselves to one who simply contemplates the natural flow of events. It is when man interferes with nature, vexes nature, tries to make her do what he wants, not what she wants, that he begins to understand how she works. and may hope to learn how to control her. And to people like Carolyn Merchant in her work Death of Nature, this narrative of science as sexual assault of nature gets linked to the justification and acceptance of sexual assault within industrial capitalist society overall.
And, you know, it's one thing to have these thinkers and these philosophers and these ecofeminists talking about these things and making these kinds of associations, but are the two of you arguing that the oil industry, in the way that it thinks and views the situation of extraction and development, that it is bringing forth or it is channeling some of these impulses and some of these attitudes?
I would argue yes, that the extractive industry, if we think about what extraction even sounds like, it's about control. It's about using new technologies to be able to control and force nature to quite literally purge her secrets, which would be these reserves of oil for energy to fuel quite literally progress of civilization, to create economic opportunities, to illuminate our homes. At least that's the argument from the oil industry.
And what about just the language of drilling, the fact that it's penetrating the earth, that it's in a sense plumbing the depths of the terrain in order to get something that I think, as Sean was mentioning before or alluding to before, it's uncompensated, right? No one's going to be compensating the earth for what we are doing to it.
Yeah, I actually think that some of what we looked at were these advertisements that people within the oil industry have put out that kind of connect extraction to gender and women expressively. And in one case, there's a really clear example that highlights this, where a drilling company put up this billboard that has this picture of a devil woman laying on her back and this drill going between her legs. And in this billboard, what they quoted on there is saying is, "Screw piles, we drill them to hell and back." And I think that narrative, this language of nature being this devil woman laying on her back and these drills penetrating her between the legs, is exactly that kind of narrative. It's that narrative of taking and going in and taking what we want, and in this way, even overly sexualizing it.
Another ad that you look at is actually a video put out by the Energy Policy Institute, which you characterize as a fossil fuel industry front group funded by groups like and organizations and companies like Exxon and the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, Peabody Coal, and others. They created, this Energy Policy Institute created a short online animated video that drew your interest. It launched on Valentine's Day in 2015. What did it show?
Well, the ad showed a young man named Joe, a white, straight young man whose girlfriend was fossil fuels. And then fossil fuels was no longer interesting to him because his punk friends, I feel like I'm in the 1980s or 90s giving a PSA about don't do drugs or something and listen to punk music. But his punk friends and Bill McKibben, who are demonized in this video, convince him that he doesn't need fossil fuels anymore. So, of course, the implication here is that he can move on to other kinds of better resources, earth-friendly, sustainable resources. And so he breaks up with fossil fuels, who's crying and is very much characterized as a girl in this video. And then once he doesn't have her anymore, we see all of the conveniences and household appliances in his home disappear in a puff of smoke when he realizes that without his girlfriend fossil fuels, he can't cook for himself. He can't even get on the internet to find another girlfriend. And so we realize that breaking up with fossil fuels is hard to do because fossil fuels is what makes our life possible and our pleasure possible.
And how would you evaluate this through the analytical lens you're presenting in this paper?
So one of the things we do here is we connect this directly to Silvia Federici's work on social reproduction, because this ad makes that link between the social reproductive of female labor in the house, from making food to taking care of them to making life possible, to fossil fuels themselves. So we make the argument that you can roughly read this video as claiming that fossil fuels provide the economic, social reproduction we need in order to have modern life, much like women are supposed to do in the bounds of a heteronormative relationship.
So this notion that he's bereft without all this labor, this uncompensated labor, this, quote, feminine labor that fossil fuels used to provide him.
Yeah, and it's not so dissimilar from what we were talking about earlier, that women's social reproductive labor is really this free gift to the economy, and that women are just available to do this uncompensated work of raising children, maintaining a home, and making sure that the man in her life is able to go and work in the wage or salary economy. And so the way that fossil fuels is depicted in this video is essentially that fossil fuels characterized as a woman is providing these social reproductive favors to this man who can now no longer get on with his life because he doesn't have this feminized labor cheaply or freely available to him.
That's the voice of Emily Ray. She and Sean Parson co-authored and presented a paper at the American Political Science Association's annual meeting last year. It's called Drill Baby Drill, Labor Accumulation and the Sexualization of Resource Extraction. Emily teaches political science at Sonoma State University. Sean Parson teaches in the Department of Politics and International Affairs at Northern Arizona University. And we'll take a short break and speak more with Sean and Emily. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Sean Parson and Emily Ray join me. Sean is assistant professor at Northern Arizona University, and Emily Ray teaches political science at Sonoma State University. And I saw a presentation they gave at last year's American Political Science Association annual meeting, and their presentation was about linking the environmentally destructive practice of fossil fuel extraction to the exploitation of women. Their project, and I'm reading from their paper, points toward a sexual logic of domination that drives the relationship of the oil industry to labor and to land. In 2012, an oil field worker and trucker named Troy McKinley, with the help of some local bars and industry workers in Williston, North Dakota, he made an effort to attract women to attend the Party in the Patch. What was that?
The Party in the Patch was an ill-fated attempt from a couple oil workers to create a public event for oil field working men to meet available women from around the area. So the goal of this party was to address, and this is a quote from one of the main organizers. He goes, "Due to the influx of workers has created a problem my straight single brethren can relate to. The northwest corner of the state is now basically a huge sausage fest." And so him and other workers were complaining about the inability to find women for relationships. And so he decided to try to have a major party in which men would have to pay $150 for the weekend, and women would only have to pay $20, and they would get heavily discounted drinks. And he tried to recruit women from Chicago, from Minneapolis, from other big cities in the region, to come out to this event to meet eligible working men, and was planning to have events like a bachelorette auction, as well as kind of wrestling matches for the men to kind of show off their skills as well.
What did McKinley say when plans for the party began to fall apart because owners of tentative locations for the party began to get cold feet about it?
Yeah, the organizer said that he was accused of bringing in prostitutes and strippers, and he countered that he was simply trying to bring in women from big cities to meet the guys who are making all this money, presumably all of these men who now have a lot of disposable income are available to be good boyfriends or husbands, that they can now afford to bring a woman in to be in this domestic role in their lives because they can afford for her to not work or for to take her to events or wine and dine, whatever it is that they want to do. So there's this presumption that the oil industry is formally and informally bringing women into the oil patch under different pretexts, but for the same essential use of finding ways to integrate women's labor into the oil industry, whether that's their domestic labor for the workers that's done outside of the industry, the companies themselves, or is to formally integrate women into the labor force by claiming the companies are interested in gender parity. So these are the different dimensions of ways that women are sort of enticed by the promise of money and maybe some kind of nuclear family, domestic stability to be able to live in the oil patch.
And tell me more about what's wrong with that, because, you know, they're appealing, they're certainly appealing to the normative nuclear family, the heterosexual couple at the head of it. But what do you find so disturbing about, you know, trying to attract women who could find a partner who can support them?
Well, I think we can contrast it, the party in the patch, to this other kind of party that's been developed by way of answering your question. This other party that's created by women and for women is called Damsel in Defense. And it's a company that was created in 2011 that throws home parties for women so they can be introduced to a range of self-defense products from pepper spray to tasers to helping them secure their digital presence as well. And that this is almost like an Avon or these other kind of parties that typically women throw to sell products to each other. But instead, this is a way for women to deal with the anxiety of life in the oil patch, because women are, of course, aware of the social alienation and the sexual violence and the threats of domestic violence that they must encounter if they're willing to live and work here. And so part of, maybe to answer your question, what's wrong with asking women to come live here is that it's totally overlooking the incredible risk that women are taking by moving there and trying to find a meaningful life in that environment. And instead of oil companies or the industry or the labor camps themselves for taking some kind of collective responsibility for dealing with this, the answer falls back on individual women and communities of women to find a way to make themselves feel safer. And again, this is going back to this neoliberal logic that all of your troubles are attributable to yourself and your own decisions.
And to kind of add to that, it is also playing off the kind of financial precarity that is often at the core of patriarchal society. So the claim here is roughly that women can find some level of financial stability and protection through being almost auctioned off in some cases in this regard, in bachelorette auctions, to male oil workers who are being paid a relatively high wage. So this is also exploitative, not just of the conditions in the Bakken, but also trying to take advantage of things like the massive wage gap around gender, as well as kind of a general social norm of the protection racket that is kind of heteronormative, patriarchal relationship dynamics.
The plans for this party, the party in the patch, pointed to or betrayed, as you write, the anxiety of the lonely, alienated male worker. And alienation is a significant concept you bring up in this paper, in this presentation that you made. And maybe we could go back to Karl Marx. What did he mean by alienation as experienced by people and by workers?
So one of the things that Marx is known for writing about and articulating is the different forms of alienation that the worker experiences in the wage economy. That would be alienation from the product of their labor, alienation from the process of their labor, alienation from fellow workers, and alienation from themselves. We can also think about alienation from the conditions that provide for that labor, which is the environment, that workers don't have the chance to experience their lives in aesthetically pleasing and intellectually stimulating ways, which includes having a non-exploitative relationship with the environment and having a relationship with one another that would be enriching. And so when we talk about alienation in this instance, we're talking about alienation from one another that might produce some of the conditions for sexual and domestic violence. What are the conditions of alienation that make us so adversarial towards each other? And some of that goes back to what Sean was talking about, the precarity of the wage laborer. Even if the salary is high, it doesn't necessarily change that people know this is temporary work, that they have to do it quickly, and that they wouldn't have time or interest in organizing as a union or creating other kinds of relationships with each other. And that surely characterizes the gender relations as well. So alienation from their ability to relate to people and to environment in a non-instrumental way.
And how might, and it's interesting because in your presentation in this paper, you bring up Freud. How might somebody who experiences alienation and therefore a kind of threat to his ego, how might that person react? I mean, you've already begun talking about it, but what might that person do in response to or in reaction to that threat?
So Sigmund and Anna Freud both work on this idea of psychological defense. And what their general argument is, if you have a concept that is really central to your ego, so in this case maybe masculinity, and it becomes threatened through any different range of things, from the inability to find a sexual partner to emasculation in your own kind of psychological space, that people will project and defend against that. And to the Freuds, how they often do this is by either creating a phobia around it and having like fear. So for instance, if someone's sexuality is threatened and their conception of being straight is very central to who they are, they could respond by creating a sense of homophobia. Instead of admitting that maybe their conception of identity is rooted in something that's not true to them, it's easier for them to blame the source of that anxiety or their perceived source of anxiety, which is gay men in this case. So in this case, you know, if you have workers who are creating this identity around masculinity in this workforce, but then are in these places in which they have no ability to find a partner or a relationship, they're actually having parts of their identity pushed against. And the response that they have is not to question the paradigm of masculinity or the paradigm of how they've constructed their identity, but to instead blame women and instead look for potentially violent or entitlement to women's bodies. So it's that they have been denied something that they're entitled to.
Sean Parson is his name. He's assistant professor of politics and international affairs at Northern Arizona University. Emily Ray also joins us. She's assistant professor of political science at Sonoma State University. And again, we are talking about a paper that they presented at a recent conference of the American Political Science Association. The paper is entitled Drill Baby Drill, Labor Accumulation and the Sexualization of Resource Extraction, in this case, the extraction of oil from the Bakken Shale Formation, which again occupies about 200,000 square miles underneath portions of Montana, North Dakota, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba. So there's another ad that the two of you address. This comes from the Canada Oil Sands Community. In fact, the name of the organization is right there on this ad. It was posted in Vancouver and on social media, and it shows two women doing what?
The ad shows two white women who appear to be sharing a romantic kiss, and the ad says, "In Canada, lesbians are considered hot. In Saudi Arabia, if you're a lesbian, you die. Why are we getting our oil from countries that don't think lesbians are hot? Choose equality, choose Canadian oil." There's almost too much to get into with this ad. One of the reasons it caught our attention is because this ad is not actually in support of equality or people being able to live their lives true to themselves. There's really nothing about the politics of queerness. This is a way to exploit women's bodies and a particular presumed sexual relation between them to stimulate presumably straight men who might have a stake in the way that we source oil in this country. And so it's an exploitative ad that's using women's sexuality in connection with extraction of oil and what we think of ourselves as a nation. Are we the kind of nation that appreciates this kind of sexual expression for the titillation of straight men? And likewise, if that's what we get to do, if that's bound up in our freedoms, then we would have a stake in where our oil comes from.
But didn't the advertiser know that lesbianism and lesbian relationships repel certain people?
I think that part of what they were playing on is this male or masculine anxiety around lesbianism. Kind of going back to Freud, oftentimes the taboos that we have that we're most fearful of are the ones that we're most titillated by. And so by providing this kind of safe, voyeuristic form of lesbianism, the goal is not to, as my friend Emily said, not to support queer politics and issues like that, but to provide kind of a voyeuristic sexual image for men to lust after. And so this plays on that taboo around kind of anxiety around lesbianism within certain forms of masculinity, while also doing it in a way that's safe and does not actually call to question any of the patriarchal assumptions within it.
Well, we can't talk about a paper called Drill Baby Drill without bringing up Sarah Palin, right? And so she popularized this slogan in her vice presidential campaign in 2008. You know, she had audiences chanting this along with her. She was goading them on. They were really getting into it. And so one might say, well, look, you know, she's a woman, and she is propagating this slogan, which sounds quite violent and masculinist. So what's the problem here?
Part of what I think was the appeal of Sarah Palin was that she provided some form of sexual fantasy for a certain contingent of the right-wing electorate. She provided this kind of beauty queen aesthetic while also promoting this grisly mom kind of domestic role. And so her use of drill baby drill, I think, shows the way in which this language of drilling is inherently sexualized in our society. The idea of that becoming a popular phrase by just John McCain, for instance, cheering it at rallies, seems impossible. It's hard to imagine throngs of white male Christian conservatives telling John McCain that they want to drill baby drill. There's just something about that that just seems impossible. So it's only because of her kind of feminine role and her kind of role as a kind of beautiful woman from an oil-rich state that allowed that to kind of work.
So Donald Trump, I mean, his calls to save the coal industry and fossil fuel jobs have been very impassioned. What do you think is behind that expressed agenda?
So Donald Trump, I think one of the main reasons for his election was first racial anxiety, but also a gender anxiety amongst men, especially white men of a certain kind of age and economic class. And part of the narrative that was constructed was that Obama and contemporary society is emasculating American society. And I see Donald Trump's defense of coal and fossil fuels as being more than just an economic discussion about how we can make money for large corporations, but about a psychosexual kind of framing of labor. So fossil fuel extraction is defined often in this very masculine language, and it's seen to represent kind of a sense of American virility and power. And so as a figure who's trying to, you know, make America, quote, great again, in this sense, he's talking about reinforcing kind of a masculine culture. And in doing so, promotion of fossil fuels is part and parcel of a cultural politics of doing so. It's that narrative of making America virile again, about making America strong again, about protecting traditional masculine male jobs. If it's not the coal fields, it's the factory.
Yeah, and I see it as protecting a kind of familiar industrial job, an industrial age labor. Coal and manufacturing is part of this sort of second wave of industrialization in the United States, and we got much more efficient at producing or turning raw materials into resources and products. So the rubber plants and tire plants of the Midwest. And so loss of the manufacturing sector is also, I believe, bringing anxieties about the identity of the man who manufactures those things. And I don't think it's exclusive on a class basis, but we certainly see some of the precarity of class associated with this. And it reminds me of the anxiety around urbanization around the end of the 19th century and transitioning into the 20th century. We see the rise of the Boy Scouts of America trying to protect against the feminization of young boys and men who would be taking these city jobs and working in offices and would not have the skills to be able to survive because of the closing of the American frontier. And so without the American frontier, there's no cowboy, there's no explorer, there's no Lewis and Clark, there are no male heroes. There's no Daniel Boone. And so part of this anxiety seems like it's historical. And so we see another transition that there's this fear that if the coal mines closed, that men would not be able to simply transition to working on the wind turbines or the solar farms. That's a different kind of work, and it probably doesn't seem like as masculine of a kind of work as well. So what would happen to the fate of a certain kind of man in the U.S.?
Right. Renewables don't involve, as far as I know, kind of this same, you know, the same kind of penetration of the earth and doing violence to the terrain.
Yeah, it's a passive collection in some ways. Of course, there's tremendous infrastructure and a lot of important conversations about the environmental impacts of establishing renewables on a large scale. But if we just think in broad terms, it's a more passive collection, and we can think about the difference between the way that we accept the free gift, if you will, of the wind and the sun from the way that you penetrate and seek out and purge the benefits from the earth. It's a totally different way of engaging the environment.
And I might add that this issue goes beyond the environmental to also being a question of American democracy in general. The American conception of the free individual, the voting citizen, the public figure, is so heavily rooted in both white supremacy, but also masculine and patriarchal norms. When you start having these cultural shifts, there's a concern that we're going to lose the American liberal individual that is at the core of the American exceptionalist argument. And so the move towards passive energy is also a move towards an effeminizing of the public, which in this narrative is also a threat to what made America, again, quote, great again.
So was your creation of this paper and the presentation of it, was it in part to increase awareness of kind of the gendered and sexualized nature of the oil industry and oil extraction? Or was it to try and shift attitudes and make some inroads into what you see as kind of the sexism and the patriarchy that pervade this industry?
I think one of our goals in this is to show that, as you describe, the sexualization of nature is intimately connected to the sexualization exploitation of the environment, and that we can't simply address environmentalism in this sort of mainstream environmental way, that if we just release our dependence on fossil fuels and we all drive a Prius, then we're going to somehow dig out of these entrenched assumptions we have about what the environment is and what it's for. And likewise, feminism isn't going to be resolved simply by removing Harvey Weinstein from power or having more women in the CEO position. That these are much deeper issues, and that to address some of these deep issues, both of them bring us back to a root issue of economy and capitalism as part of the production of the cultural and economic conditions that produce the exploitation of women and environment, and that these two things are inseparable as well.
Yeah, and you really, what you're suggesting is that we need to kind of go right into the psyche, right? The psychosexual impulse that drives some of these behaviors. And we might not even be aware of these impulses and really understand them. And yet they are, in your opinion and in Sean's opinion, and, you know, I'm convinced, moving us in certain directions and inclining us toward taking certain positions and having certain attitudes that are really reactionary and harmful to people like women.
Yeah, I think that's one of the hardest tasks. For so long, there's been this narrative of rationality that's been at the core of the Western experience. And even on the left, there's this kind of assumption of economic importance, which is there. But there's very little that tries to blur that. And I think one of the things we wanted to highlight is a lot of the decisions around fossil fuel extraction are not rational economic calculations only. They have these psychosexual components that is almost in the dialectical relation with that material world. And so to just think of these as rational decisions might lead you to, you know, come up with policies that don't address the actual cultural or psychological benefit of certain practices as well. So it's a really tough task to kind of complicate this economic narrative by bringing in these psychosexual cultural identity concepts within it. But I think it's really essential if the left wants to confront capitalism, confront ecocide, to really come to terms with the fact that this world is complex and these relationships are really complex, and we need to unravel a lot more of that complexity.
Sean Parson teaches in the Department of Politics and International Affairs at Northern Arizona University. Emily Ray teaches in the Department of Political Science at Sonoma State University. I hope that this paper will eventually be published. It's called Drill Baby Drill, Labor Accumulation and the Sexualization of Resource Extraction. Emily, Sean, thanks so much for joining me this hour.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.